Hello and welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the unceded homelands of the Mohican people, who are known today as the Stockbridge-Munsee community. I'm Sina Bazila Hickey.
And I'm Andrea Cunliffe. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we begin with an update on Save the Pine Bush, in which Mark Dunley speaks with Lynn Jackson. Then Andrew Lynn attended the meeting to build a skate park under the Hoosick Street Bridge in Troy. Later on, we hear Shannon Faulkner's speech at a recent vigil for Megan Mevron, our Hudson Mohawk Magazine colleague who is still missing. After that, Pinkster, a historic African-American celebration, returns. And finally, we head to the performing arts space in Chatham at PS 21. But first, here are the headlines.
Benita Law Diao has been nominated to be the first Black member of the board of the Adirondack Park Agency. For 32 years, she worked for the State Health Department and is a dietitian by training. Law Diao has worked with food banks and food pantries across the state, including in the Adirondacks.
Hundreds of Capital District residents have written to the state judge urging him to keep Saratoga Springs and Amsterdam in the Capital Region and the chorus for the congressional district presently represented by Paul Tonko. The protest about the Capital District was the largest that the court has received. The state's highest court threw out the lines drawn by the state legislator for Congress and the state Senate on the grounds that they were written to favor the elections of Democrats.
The New York Times reports that Congress member Hakeem Jeffries, the second highest ranking African-American member in Congress, has launched an aggressive effort attacking the redrawn congressional lines as an example of Jim Crow. Jeffries notes that the proposed lines breaks up several traditional Black communities in New York City into different districts. A broad coalition of public interests and minority advocacy groups have informed the court that the proposed changes would risk diluting the power of historically marginalized communities.
The Gazette reports that former Saratoga County Administrator Spencer Helwig has filed a federal lawsuit against the county that alleges his firing in January 2021 was a result of an unlawful retaliation. The complaint alleges the county, in an effort led by Chairman of the Saratoga County Board of Supervisors, Theodore T. Constance Jr., removed Helwig from a position he held for about a decade because Helwig supported the county's former human resource director in a gender discrimination complaint against Kunstnerd.
State Comptroller Tom DiNapoli is criticizing the State Department of Labor for overseeing a dysfunctional but sprawling workforce development program that is supposed to train New Yorkers for the jobs of today and tomorrow. Despite 500 training programs offered by the state, there's no functioning governing body as required by federal law to coordinate the program and programs and ensure they are meeting the needs of people.
And the city of Troy city officials will activate neighborhood cooling stations over the weekend in response to a heat advisory issued by the National Weather Service.
That's it for the headlines.
First up, Save the Pine Bush continues to challenge the proposed development of this nature preserve as an office park, apartment complex, and a Costco. Lynn Jackson discusses the issue along with the solar farm in Colonnay with Hudson Mohawk Magazine's Mark Dunley.
We're joined by Lynn Jackson, one of the volunteer leaders of Save the Pine Bush. And we have a number of things we wanted to catch up with the Save the Pine Bush work. But recently, the appellate division, the middle level court, throughout a lawsuit by Save the Pine Bush challenging the town of Gilliland's approval of some ongoing development in the Pine Bush area. So Lynn, what was the issues that you were raising or challenging, and what did the court say?
Raised the issue of the proposed developments in the town of Gila, which included a large office complex development, a Costco, which included 18 pump gas station, and an undefined office complex. And the ruling ultimately ruled that was it. We couldn't challenge these proposed developments anymore. The court did say that we had standing, which is extremely important. So Save the Pine Bush was given standing in this case. And the Supreme Court, it was the appellate division agreed that we have standing. And the appellate division agreed that the issues that we raised in our lawsuit had never been heard before. However, then the appellate division decided to rule on the merits of our case. And they said, well, you lose. And now the projects can go ahead, unfortunately.
Now, this was a middle level court decision. Are you considering at all, challenging it to the state's highest court, the Court of Appeals, or this basically it and the projects will move ahead?
This is basically it for our court challenges. There's really no more challenge. The ruling was 5-0, and we don't have any. There's no appeal of right to the Court of Appeals. And so we're kind of unfortunately finished with our court appeals in the town of Gilderland, which, of course, to me raises the big question of what is the town of Gilderland going to do about protecting the undeveloped parts of the Pine Bush ecosystem in the town that are privately held? And that, of course, is a question for the town board. And I think the town board really needs to look very closely at what kind of developments they're approving in the town of Gilderland and how they really should look at how are they going to protect the rest of the Pine Bush ecosystem that's not developed in the town of Gilderland.
Now, has the town board, which, you know, goes up for election every few years, have they really embraced their role as a protector of the Pine Bush, or do they just sort of see this as something that legally we get forced to do, but we're not really all that committed to it?
Since in our court case, the supervisor of the town of Gilderland actually made the oral argument in the case before the appellate division, he is clearly completely pro-development. And the town board of the town of Gilderland does not seem to be inclined at all to look at protection of the Pine Bush ecosystem, which I think is very unfortunate for the Pine Bush and, of course, for the residents of the town of Gilderland and everyone else who was affected by, you know, the lack of preservation of this beautiful ecosystem that we have.
Is there any chance that other either private or, you know, state funds might, you know, show up to, you know, actually purchase, if not the property itself, some of the development rights for some of the additional, you know, property that, you know, people would like to protect in the Pine Bush?
Well, certainly the Albany Pine Bush Preserve Commission has been working on acquisition. Unfortunately, they can only do so much. When it comes to land preservation and this, you know, for the Pine Bush and other places, we really need to look at how do we redevelop the areas that have already been developed and are maybe vacant and unused and leave our undeveloped areas alone. And I think this is a huge challenge for the town of Gilderland. And I don't think at this point that the town board of the town of Gilderland is really understanding that they really need to do more, or Gilderland is just going to become one massive shopping mall parking lot. But of course, they're not the town of Gilderland is not the only municipality where the Pine Bush exists. And there are other proposals going on right now in the town of Colony that we're very concerned about. And I can talk about that for a minute if you like.
Well, I understand one of those proposals relates to development of the solar farm. And as a climate activist, you know, of course, we want to see more solar and renewable energy. But I understand there's some problems with a particular proposal for a solar farm in Colony.
Yes. Unfortunately, I mean, obviously, Save the Pine Bush completely supports solar farms. We are completely behind stopping using fossil fuels, looking at renewable energy, all that kind of thing. But how do you balance building a solar farm in a globally rare ecosystem, which is what the pine bush is? This solar farm would be huge. It's 75 acres. The Albany Pine Bush Preserve Commission has been trying to acquire the land for years at this point, but the owner won't sell to them. And I think that a much better solution would be, like, let's be a little innovative here. We should do some kind of land trade so that we can protect this area in the pine bush and trade, you know, like the state of New York could do this. They could take the solar farm and trade it for, say, being able to build a solar farm at the Harriman office campus, you know, to build where, you know, build solar panels on the roofs of every building in Harriman and build solar panels in the parking lots, because that's already, you know, clearly already developed. So why can't we have a solution like that? It just seems to me that I understand the efficiency of building these massive solar farms where you just have, quote, open land, but I don't see that this is really a good thing, because not only are we experiencing severe climate change, which we all know about, but we're in the sixth major extinction of species on Earth. And it seems like this particular proposal in the pine bush has, what do we balance? And clearly we need to do something about climate change, no doubt about it. But on the other hand, do we really take land that is in a globally rare ecosystem that may affect the plants and the animals living there and build a solar farm there? I just feel like there's got to be a better solution. I think the state of New York should get involved. They should do a land trade. Land trades have been done. There's been two land trades that have been done in the past in the pine bush. And I just think that that's what we need to do.
I will just point out, as a climate advocate, one of the things that, you know, we have proposed a much stronger law than, you know, the CLCPA, which was adopted. And one of the big differences was also saying that we should require that local municipalities actually right now, years ago, actually, begin to cite where they want to put solar and wind farms. And so it was the local municipality itself initiating that process, not waiting for developers to come and then reacting to what the developers, who often, let's just find the easiest place to develop. But I also know, you know, it was also a massive fight down in Columbia County, a much larger solar farm, I believe, which was stalled for many years, but they created a group called Friends of Columbia Solar, and they actually seemed to have mediated between the local residents opposed to it and the developers, and they appear to have come up with a solution that most people seem to live with once they actually got the developers and the local residents to sit down and talk. Is any of those type of discussions taking place with this particular solar farm?
Oh, absolutely not. There's been no discussion at all between the location of it. I mean, obviously, it seems like we have a willing landowner that wants to sell his land, and we have this massive, and I believe this huge, huge company that wants to come in and buy the land and build their solar farm. But there has been nothing like that. There will be a public hearing on June 1st at the town of Colony at their, it's a zoning board of appeals, I believe, at 347 Old Niskayuna Road in Latham at 7 o'clock p.m. June 1st. And people should come in here and listen and speak about, you know, the conflict that we have here between how do we protect our beautiful pine bush, and at the same time, how do we promote renewable energy, and how do you locate these?
Well, Lynn, we're out of time. Lynn Jackson, Save the Pine Bush. If people want more information, you have a website?
Savethepinebush.org. The email is contact@savethepinebush.org. Thank you so much, Mark. I appreciate it.
This has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Lynn Jackson is a frequent guest on Hudson Mohawk Magazine to talk about Save the Pine Bush. So if you want interested listeners can find more of those on our website, mediasanctuary.org.
City officials held a public meeting at the River Street Market May 19th here in Troy to discuss the proposed skate park beneath the Hoosick Street Bridge. In that discussion, the state park, skate park, and they wanted to collect feedback from residents and local skaters. Andrew from Hudson Mohawk Magazine was there, and he brings you this report.
This is Andrew Lin reporting for WOOC. For several years, I've been talking about and advocating for a skate park under the Hoosick Street Bridge. So I was very excited when, around the beginning of the pandemic, the city started talking in earnest about this possibility too. And an ad hoc group, of which I am part of, formed to explore and advance the idea. First, I should explain where we are talking about. If you know where Unity House is and the CDTA bus garage, then you're in the right area. Immediately to the west of the entrance of the CDTA bus garage under the Hoosick Street Bridge, there is a kind of mysterious piece of land that's a sand pit surrounded by a low knee wall and a set of stairs. I have no idea what it was originally designed for. Maybe urban volleyball? The ledges are waxed, and it's clear that skaters and bikers use this space somewhat, but the pavement is really rough, and I'm sure it's not a great place for skating. It is a fine place for hard drug users to get out of the way, so I'm sure that happens. But mostly it sits empty and is not suited for much else. A few years back, a mini halfpipe appeared in the sand pit and was instantly being skated and documented on social media until a couple weeks later, it was burnt to the ground. So I like to think of that as some kind of omen and also a pretty sweet piece of direct action to bring the halfpipe there in the middle of the night. So where are we now? The city has hired a skate park design firm called Grindline out of Seattle to create a design for the park. And on Tuesday, May 18th, a representative from Grindline led a public meeting and brainstorming session, which was held at the River Street Market food court. I'd never been to this fancy eatery before, but it was pretty cool, and there was a nice spot in there for this type of event. But the air conditioning was extremely loud, and it made recording of the presentation pretty much impossible. I did get a chance to talk afterwards to the city engineer and a representative from Grindline, who's also the CEO of the company. So I wanted to share those interviews. Check them out.
My name is Aaron Vera. I'm the city engineer of the city of Troy. Tonight we had our first public meeting for the Hoosick Street Skate Park. It's a project that's been in the works for about a year now, started once COVID hit, and we've got some funding for the design of a skate park.
Cool. And as I understand it, there's been a company hired to produce a design, Grindline. From your point of view, what is the timeline for the potential of this look like?
Well, we're hoping that by early July, we'll have a concept plan from Grindline. At that point, we'll probably have our second public meeting to kind of hash out that plan and see what changes or tweaks need to be made. Once we have a final design, which should be sometime end of August, the next step will be finding funding sources to get this thing built.
And what kind of, what do you think that looks like?
Well, we're hoping that the city will have some funding to either match or to contribute to this, but we're also looking for private partners, and we're hoping that some of the skaters in the community will be able to help us find those partners.
Cool, thanks. You seem pretty excited about this in general. Do you have anything to add in terms of what brings you to the, you know, being stoked on a project like this?
Well, I was a skater when I was younger. My brothers were both skaters, and it was one of the things I noticed was lacking when I first moved to Troy 12 years ago. And so I'm just thrilled to be part of the project now.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Matt Fliege, CEO at Grindline Skate Parks, here giving a presentation to gather feedback for a new skate park concept for Troy.
And how do you think it went tonight?
I think it went really well. We got a lot of great feedback. We've got a really positive, organized, well-spoken group of skateboarders here. So I think it was a success, and we got lots of great ideas.
And where are some places that you've designed skate parks, your firm has designed skate parks, and that have been carried out and exist today?
All over the country and all over the world. In this general area, some examples would be Jamestown, Springville, Ellicottville, Auburn. All those projects are kind of in different states right now, and but yeah, they're on their way to becoming a reality.
Are there any internationally that you're like particularly, you know, proud of as an organization or personally?
Yeah, I mean, we did a handful of parks in Israel, which was definitely a challenge. Fellenparken in Copenhagen, Denmark is definitely one of the favorites. But yeah, I mean, and then a ton of parks here in the United States.
And for the listeners out there who might be wondering, like, I know the timeline varies greatly, but can you give some advice on what we're looking at in terms of the potential timing for this to come to fruition?
Yeah, so we want to come back and present a preliminary concept in early July and get feedback, you know, from the group, same group, and anybody else is definitely welcome. And then finalize the concepts, in July, and basically get into construction documents in late summer, fall of 22, and then construction sounds like will be to be determined based on funding available.
Great. And the space under the bridge, I mean, you've probably worked with a lot of sort of blank slates or things that were something else that you transitioned into a skate park over the course of the design process. How does this hit you as like a slate to be working with?
I think anytime we get to work under an overpass, it's a unique opportunity. I mean, you get shade relief from the sun and the summer months. You can get, you know, relief from rain and even snow in the winter months. So I think it's unique. Like I said, a unique opportunity and something we want to take into consideration when we do the design, if we can utilize, you know, the overpass in all those different ways.
And we're looking at a maximum of like 17,000 square foot. From your presentation, it sounds like that's a decent amount of space to be working with. Would you agree?
Yeah, I would agree. I'd say an average size park is probably between 8,000 and 12,000 square feet. And this one, even if we take a little bit of that real estate for, you know, amenities or a spectator area, you're still going to be looking at 14,000 to 15,000 feet of skateable concrete.
Cool. Any other final comments or thoughts?
Nope. Just it was great being here. And again, it was a really good, positive group. You know, the skate community here in Troy seems like they got a real positive vibe going. And, you know, everybody was just polite and friendly, and it was a good trip out.
So there you have it, folks, some positive news floating in the sea of challenging headlines and struggles. I just want to say that with all the gentrification happening in our city and the capitalist quote-unquote development projects, the construction of a skate park would be a positive in all the ways that don't have dollar signs attached to them. I really hope we can pull this one through. This is Andrew Lin reporting for WOOC. Thanks for listening.
That was Andrew reporting on the proposed skate park under the Hoosick Street Bridge. And you can find this project on Instagram at Hoosick Unity Skate Park.
And for those of you just tuning in, I'm Andrea Cunliffe.
And I'm Sina Bazila Hickey. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network on WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany, WOOGLP 92.7 FM Troy, and WCAALP 107.3 FM Albany. This program comes from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the unceded homelands of the Mohican people, who are known today as the Stockbridge-Munsee community.
And next up, Megan Mehran, a Hudson Mohawk Magazine producer, has been missing since March 27th, 2022. Last Friday, a vigil was held at Shaker High, where she's a teacher. Her brother, Peter Napel, students, administrators, colleagues, and friends all spoke. Today, we air a speech by Megan's friend and former teaching colleague, Shannon Faulkner.
When I began teaching at Chatham High School in 2010, and I first met Megan, I knew she had taught nearly every class that our school offered. Holocaust and genocide studies, detective fiction, creative writing, journalism, AP literature, and so many more. In one of our first conversations, she casually quoted Hannah Arendt. She has this enormous breadth of knowledge, truly just staggering. But it wasn't until we became friends that I came to know her humility, her compassion, her silliness, and her sense of humor. I learned that Megan was a poet, an activist, an advocate for the arts, an editor of books, a hospice volunteer. It's such a precious rarity to meet someone who is so brilliant, but also so completely unassuming, so totally welcoming, and so deeply invested in the collective community. But today I want to think about Ms. Marone in her role as a teacher. For Ms. Marone, her work in the classroom has always been about the power that language holds, that reading together, writing together, and speaking together hold. Not for A's or other scholastic accolades or awards or honor rolls or college acceptances, but for the real prize, the best and only prize that matters, which is the community and connection that learning together enables. Teaching with Ms. Marone and calling her friend are among my most cherished blessings in this life. And I feel deeply honored to be able to share some of what I've learned from her with you today. When we taught together, I loved nothing more than visiting her classroom at lunch or after school. Her classroom always had the look and feel of a beautiful museum. But unlike a museum, it was always bustling with noise and activity. Students were writing together or sharing their writing as part of the Inkblot writing club she ran. Others were discussing metaphysics and the problem of evil as part of her philosophy club. And some were just dancing, like actually dancing, or singing, or playing music, or playing a ukulele, or sharing videos with each other that they'd seen and liked. And there she always was, there in the middle of it all, usually knee to knee with a student or two, totally immersed in the conference that she was having with them about their work, that they were sharing with her. All while other students laughed at a YouTube video or tap danced at the front of the room. By now, these students are all adults, and I think most of them would tell you that it was in Ms. Marone's classroom at lunch and after school where they found a home in school, where they unearthed their talents and made friends and laughed and felt a part of things. Many of these students were teenagers who didn't quite fit into the strict parameters of appearance or values or activities or the other superficial mandates that high school can sometimes impose. And Ms. Marone kept an eye on these kids, the vulnerable ones. And she showed them by example how to live out the fullness of who they are with as much joy as honesty. Her willingness to be vulnerable herself always made other people feel safe. And it wasn't so different for me or for our fellow colleagues. I'm an introvert by nature, a quiet person, but this is not the first time I find myself speaking before an assembled audience, urged on in a way by Ms. Marone. Years ago, she and I found we had a common passion for the natural world, for environmentalism, and I expressed frustration that in the school where we taught, this issue didn't seem to get the attention it needed. Why don't you tell other teachers why you care so much about the issue? Why you think it's so important, she suggested. People would really listen to you. Nothing about my position in the school at the time suggested that that would be true. I'd only been there a few years. But somehow, I believed her, because I felt that she really listened to me, and I knew she really did believe that I had good ideas to share. And so I did speak to my colleagues, together with Ms. Marone, on more than one occasion. And so many programs and initiatives at our school have grown out of that initial step that I wouldn't bore you with the list of them here today. And it didn't end there. Why don't we run a workshop for teachers about the spiritual and psychological benefits of writing? Ms. Marone asked me one fall. Who's going to come to that, I wondered. But again, something deep down whispered to me that people would come. And they did. And that day in our little workshop, led by Ms. Marone, a design and technology teacher began a book-length collection of love letters to his wife. A PE teacher broke down in tears and shared with us about a recent loss she had endured and wrote the most moving piece about it. Teachers from kindergarten to 12th grade came together as fellow humans, not just as colleagues, that morning. I was in awe of her gifts as a teacher. Why don't we start a book club? Why don't you get your supervisor credential? Why don't we start giving talks about climate change in the community? Why don't you write an article about what you're doing in the classroom? Her questions kept coming. Ms. Marone has the kind of brilliance that shines so bright that it illuminates and lights the sparks that we all have in us. When I think about start trying something new or about taking a creative risk, it's her voice I hear whispering up to me from deep within my soul that says, try, that says, you have gifts to share. And I suspect that many of you here today can hear that voice too, if you're listening. Education for Ms. Marone has always been about love, a love for her students, for caring for the most vulnerable, and for what education makes possible, for how it enables us to see into ourselves and beyond ourselves, into the lives and experiences of others across time and space and culture, to discover what was always true, that we are all on this journey here on Spaceship Earth together. As Ms. Marone always says, quoting her beloved Carl Sagan, we are made of star stuff. She sees magic in us. She sees the universe in us. And her encouragement never ended, and it hasn't ended for any of us, even now. If there's one thing Ms. Marone has always asked of her students, it's to question binaries, to question the simple read that things are either this or they are that. In the spirit of celebrating the and the also, rather than the either or the or, what we English teachers often call the paradox, I'll say this. Ms. Marone is missing, and she's also right here today with all of us, imprinted on our souls, as all of our best teachers are. And adopting her ethic of care, that sacred code that Ms. Marone's whole life embodies, is one way to honor her as our teacher and to fill our own brief time here on this planet with joy and with meaning. Earlier in the year, Ms. Marone sent me this message. It was just a text, but like all of her texts, it was pretty poetic. She said, "Isn't it mind-blowing to consider how amazing, school systems can be. The creativity, the honoring of growth, solemn respect, and a time of silence as people pass through stages and relationships change. Like school could be, and maybe always is, despite all odds, the beating heart of a civilization. I will continue to pray for Ms. Marone's safe return to her family, to her friends, and to her classroom, because we all have so much more to learn from her.
That was an excerpt from the vigil at Shaker High School for Megan Marone, an important and beloved member of our community, recorded by Elizabeth Press. For information related to helping find Megan, please visit Find Megan Marone. Megan is spelled with G-H, last name Marone, M-A-R-O-H-N. Help us keep the light on.
Now, did you know that the Dutch colonies had an annual spring event that allowed enslaved people to gather in large groups with free Blacks? The historic Pinkster tradition returns to Albany. Hudson Mohawk Magazine's Bria Barthel went to learn more.
Hi, this is Bria Barthel for Hudson Mohawk Magazine. When I moved to Albany in the 1980s, there was a festival that was part of Tulip Fest called Pinkster Fest, and that disappeared a few years later. I discovered that Pinkster was an event that went back not just to the 1980s, but the 1880s, 1780s, and even 1680s. So to hear a little more about Pinkster, I'm talking with Cordell Reeves, Historic Preservation Program Analyst with New York State Parks, Recreation, and Historic Preservation. Cordell, what is Pinkster and how is it coming back?
Pinkster is an important part of our shared history. It's an important part of our shared cultural heritage. It demonstrates the blending of cultures in some ways, because you have something that begins as the Dutch observance of Pentecost. So New York, this region, was a Dutch colony for a very long time. And the Dutch took time out to observe Pentecost on the Christian calendar. And during that time, the people they held in bondage, the enslaved community, were allowed to have some free time to themselves. And during this time, they could travel more freely. They could gather with people that they hadn't seen in a long time and come together. And this period of time became infused with African traditions, traditions coming out of the Congo especially. So the drumming, the dances, the food, the stories, the songs, all of these things took on an air and were infused with African traditions.
And let's take a moment there. You said that they're able to travel freely and gather. On the 364 other days of the year, there were limits on how many enslaved people could get together at any one place, right?
Those limits, those rules, those codes, if you will, change over time. So what enslaved people could experience and expect under the Dutch versus under the British versus under the Americans shifts. So over time, their ability to gather becomes more and more constrained. Some of this is happening in response to various rebellions that have taken place, fires that have been set in New York City, and European colonists wanting to be extra cautious about the potential for something to happen. But Pinkster remains, even under the British, even in Albany up until 1811, Pinkster remains something that the enslaved community and the free African community pushes for, even negotiates about. So there are records of people who are being sold to other people, and they're negotiating during their own sale with the person who is going to be their new supposed owner, saying, well, I need at least 4 days during Pinkster. I need 3 days during Pinkster. I need 5 days during Pinkster. Because this becomes one of really two times during the year, other time being New Year holiday later, where they can travel freely and they can get together. This is one of the two times where they can actually do that. And it becomes extremely important as a way to reconnect with people they haven't seen, reconnect with family, reconnect with friends, maintain a sense of community. So the celebrations grow over time.
I want to continue with that, but first I wanted to say that concept of the person who is enslaved negotiating, I wouldn't think that they'd have any power to negotiate.
It varies greatly, and especially varies greatly depending on the situation and depending on the personalities involved. Some, you know, enslavers were more willing to negotiate on a fine point like that with the insurance that, oh, okay, well, I'm doing this, then this person is going to be perhaps more willing to not run away, more willing to work with me. It varies from case to case. It wasn't something that you see a lot of references to, certainly. I don't want to give a false sense of agency there, but there was a level of agency in some of the daily choices enslaved people were making. And sometimes that was constrained by new laws and new European powers coming in, and sometimes it was allowed to continue for a while, like in the case of Pinkster.
So getting back to Pinkster, you have two events coming up. The first is a virtual discussion about understanding Pinkster on Wednesday, May 25th at 6:30.
The virtual discussion, I expect, is going to be a wonderful overview for people about the details of Pinkster, how it was celebrated, what its origins are, what its African roots are. We're pleased to have Chief Baba Neil Clark, who is a master percussionist, who has performed all over the world, and who has been telling the story of Pinkster to audiences probably for the past 30 years. He was just presenting at the New York State Folklore Society, talking about Pinkster and sharing that story there. And with him will be Lavada Nahan. She is the interpreter for African American history and culture for New York State Office of Parks. She will be sharing her stories about Pinkster. She has been a part of celebrating Pinkster at multiple sites, from historic Huguenot Street, Van Cortlandt Manor, and she has a lot of wonderful insights about the foodways as a culinary historian and also as an interpreter about what enslaved people were doing, what cultures were being infused into this event, whether they be Congolese or from other places on the African continent.
Now, you said that Lavada Nahan is the interpreter of African American history and culture for the New York State Office of Parks, Recreation, and Historic Preservation. Is she sort of like the final say, or it's just that that's the main focus of her job? What does the interpreter mean?
This is a new position. It's a very new position she's been on now for, I guess, the past 2.5 years. And the purpose of her position is to assist all of the state historic sites in bringing forward the stories that they haven't been telling. So our goal going forward has been what we call the Our Whole History concept. So most of our focus at many of our sites for a long time has been on the standard European hero narrative. We are trying to move to a more holistic interpretation that includes, you know, tribal nations, that includes Africans, both free and enslaved, and their descendants, that talks about immigrant labor, that talks about all the people who have largely been marginalized or left out.
So that event, the virtual discussion on Wednesday, May 25th at 6:30 p.m., and it's an Eventbrite event. So now let's hear about the event at Schuyler Mansion, and that's the actual Pinkster celebration, and it sounds like a grand time.
It's going to be a wonderful event. It's going to be an outdoor event. There'll be activities for children and families. There'll be live entertainment. A group called the Pinkster Players, which was led by Chief Baba Neil Clark will be performing a reenactment in period dress of a Pinkster celebration and crowning a Pinkster king at the end of the day, which was part of the tradition also. We'll have Melody Africa, who's a dance and drumming troupe out of New Paltz, New York, who will come and perform. The poet Dee Collin, she will be coming to give a portrayal of Sojourner Truth, because Sojourner Truth mentions Pinkster in her narratives that she dictated to others as being so important that even when she had her freedom, she wanted to go back to experience that celebration, but thought it might be dangerous for her. This is something that covers so much of New York State history, not just for people of African descent, but as part of our whole story that's been kind of forgotten and left out for many years. So we want to help bring it back. And this year it's being celebrated not just in Albany, but also there's a celebration going on in Kingston. There's celebrations going on in Uptown New York City. And we're hoping that it's going to spread even further, because originally it was celebrated every place where the Dutch had a foothold, including, you know, parts of Northern New Jersey and Long Island. So we'd love to see it come back and be as popular as Juneteenth is today.
And for information on Pinkster, P-I-N-K-S-T-E-R, I'm looking at the website of friendsofschuylermansion.org. It highlights storytelling, drumming, dance, historic performances, vendors, food. And the date and time again?
The date is going to be June 4th, and it'll be from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m.
Schuyler Mansion?
It's 32 Catherine Street in Albany, New York. And there's still plenty of slots available for the panel discussion, so anyone who wants to learn more should sign up. There's no registration required for the event itself, just for the panel.
Thanks so much for telling us about Pinkster.
Thank you.
All that information, those links, the times, you can find those along with the segment on our website, mediasanctuary.org.
PS21, located in Chatham, New York, has a very interesting lineup for the season. Sina visited the state-of-the-art theater to get the scoop.
We're walking on these back fields, and which is littered with these blooming trees, and we have a great view over to the Catskills, right?
That's right. And so you see it's this 100 acres that is a former apple farm, and that's where PS21 is. It's kind of an interesting concept where you have this state-of-the-art theater, and then in the middle of gorgeous fields and meadows and apple orchards. So it's kind of heaven. You know, we want to keep it wild, and at the same time our campus and trails are open to the entire community, and anybody can come in at any part of the day and take a hike, bring a dog for a walk, a significant other.
Could you please introduce yourself?
I'm Yelena Siyanko, Executive and Artistic Director of PS21, Performance Spaces for the 21st Century in Chatham, New York.
So what is PS21?
PS21, Performance Spaces for the 21st Century. The theater was completed in 2018. We kind of launched during the pandemic, I would say. And it's as you see, it's two stages. One is an open-air pavilion theater, which allowed us to be open even during the pandemic, where our audiences could be comfortable, but we also used all of our landscape as a platform and for connection between audiences, nature, and the arts. So we staged productions not just in the theater, but also using our trails and meadows. And that, especially during the pandemic, was very important to connect people to each other, to themselves, to their bodies. Use our trails to encourage walking, being in nature, in the sunshine. And I think that kind of way of connecting people and embracing people of all walks of life is really part of our mission. For that, we formed a special initiative called Pathways, Blazing Trails for a Sustainable Future. Pathways as both literal pathways that we are, you and I are walking on right now, but also pathways philosophically, pathways to each other, to our bodies, ourselves. And it's not just a parallel opportunistic initiative for community engagement where, let's say, a company of dance company comes and then they have time and they do something for the community, but we really are developing a parallel stream of programming for year-round residents. The kind of programming, just to give you an example, it can be ecology walks, but also specific productions, and in particular international contemporary circus, which we think is one of the most interesting democratic forms of connecting people. We also present most of our Pathways programs free of charge or at low cost.
So it sounds like this programming is as a way to make the arts more accessible for people so that it's not just you come and sit and you watch a performance that somebody else is doing, but you're actually able to interact and maybe have those tools transferred, that knowledge transferred, and as a way to just engage people rather than have it just a showcase.
Absolutely. And it's not just about free or accessible tickets, kind of thinking we are going to create it and you come, but it's also taking productions to where people are, but as importantly, inventing and staging productions that involve participatory or immersive component, just like this year we are bringing a very interesting participatory theater installation from France, designed by a South Korean artist who lives in Marseille. He was inspired by protests, street protests in Seoul when conceiving of this production. And it cannot happen without the audience participation. So that is one of the aspects of the kind of Pathways programming that we are also very interested in, so that the audience is also engaged as protagonists, as participants, and not just as passive observers.
In the blurb for your programming, it states that you're reaching out to farmers and local people, brewers, all these kind of local people. What is your outreach strategy?
You are probably referring to one of the Pathways programs called Middle Ground, and that's connected to our presentation debut in the United States and North American premiere of Reincarnation by Q-Dance and Kudus Anikeko. It's a company from Lagos, Nigeria. Middle Ground, it's kind of this African hang, an all-embracing shout-out of where all community members participate. So the idea is that culture is not created by famous choreographers or museum directors or, you know, or important people in the community, but culture is created by everybody. And we conceived of this kind of outreach where we hope for the different community members become protagonists. A few years ago in 2020, when we developed a film series called Firefighters Select, when we invited different firefighting squads to contribute to curate one film for each of those series. So our outreach strategy was that we just reached out directly to people in the community, and the same stands for Middle Ground. We wrote to electricians, car mechanics, we knew bakers, farmers in the area, religious leaders, community leaders, also Alima Cuisine, the wonderful West African cuisine chef, who is also going to be taking part in Middle Ground. So it's really, there is no strategy behind it. It's really trying to reach the community directly. And it's really the community that creates life here in Columbia County. I mean, we interact with them. We shop. We eat we eat the food together. And so they are all part of this incredibly important ecosystem of life and who we are in Columbia County.
So let's talk about that programming coming up. You have a lot of really interesting things coming. What should listeners know?
Well, so Pathways is a huge kind of initiative for free and low-cost programming throughout the summer. And then in parallel, there are also performances on stage. And this summer in particular, we have 7 international productions coming. I already mentioned one from Nigeria, Lagos, which we will open our season on June 3 and 4. And then right now, and we'll go to the dance barn and the artist house to see where our South Korean team from 2 theaters from Seoul is staying. Currently, they're developing a new work, which will be premiered. It's a world premiere. It will be shown next weekend. So there is a production from South Korea. There is what we call the Global Dance Series, where it's not just companies from places like Nigeria, but there is one company from Israel, 2 companies from France, 1 from South Africa. There is also Global Music with Haitian band Vox Sambu, and then Dacha Bracha, a Ukrainian ethno-punk band. A lot of our programming, because of this marvelous landscape and our obsession with the crisis of Anthropocene and where we are and the planet, is very much also focused on the work that is related to the land, our relationship to the land, the extinction even, which is what Femme Fatale with Philippe Ken from France is about. And so that's the film The Earth. Also, we thought it would be a perfect component of our pathways, kind of unfolding dramaturgies of the Anthropocene. We put a tagline on this.
Many people don't feel welcome in art spaces. Why do you think that PS21 is different?
You are so right about this, and I want to say that we aspire to make PS21 welcoming and open to all, and I don't feel like we are there yet, and I feel that strongly that it's probably just this vector in society which discourages arts participation, because if you look at in this glorious Hudson Valley in the Berkshires, the ticket prices are so expensive to festivals all around us, you know, Tanglewood, Jacob's Pillow. I mean, there are, of course, more affordable productions, but not the productions on stage that you know, the kind of more complicated, if you will, dance performances. And that's, to me, a real deterrent, the ticket prices, so that people of your age can't afford to come. People who have young families in their 30s and their 40s, they cannot afford to buy tickets to performances. And I think by keeping prices low, as we did last year, and then during the pandemic, we were able to build a much younger audience.
So for listeners who are interested in visiting PS21, how can they get more information and what would you like to leave them with?
First, they should just come and hike our trails. That's what I would say. And then if they stumble upon things that they might be interested in, we have posters in our theater. But I probably would want to wish everybody to stay well and healthy in this still time of the pandemic and connect to each other. And I think arts is a way of being together, creating the community, and we should not forget that. It's kind of a good way of spending quality time together with each other and also meeting new people.
That was Elena Sianko, Executive and Artistic Director at PS21, speaking with me. And for more information on the upcoming schedule and the landscape for hiking, PS21 Chatham.org. And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm co-host and engineer Sina Bazila-Hickey.
And I'm Andrea Cunliffe. Tune in every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to hear local news or stream Sanctuary Radio at mediasanctuary.org. Hudson Mohawk Magazine is also available on demand as a podcast or as individual stories at mediasanctuary.org. So until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.